From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Joining us this time is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder and also Forrest Wilder's hat. Good to have you both on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Observer politics writer Christopher Hooks. We had Chris on the show a few weeks back. Since then, he's been hired by The Observer, and he's already doing a bang-up job. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, good to be here.
Also with us is RH Reality Check senior political reporter Andrea Grimes, who was nice enough to stop watching the Olympics to join us on the show. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
How do you get senior in your title? I want to get senior in my title.
It was a long, involved
You want to
process.
Be senior associate
yeah,
editor?
Yeah, why not? That sounds pretty impressive. Better than junior, right?
Fair
there was
point.
Luge involved.
I see.
Okay, well, let's discuss some news. You guys down to talk about some news?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I thought the news we would talk about is the gubernatorial campaign, because last week we did not have an update on it. And so, I think we're overdue. So what's going on with the Wendy Davis campaign?
Well, a couple weeks ago, they were coming back from something of a low point, maybe, right? They had been called out by a lot of kind of observers for some policy stuff, and also maybe the perception that they maybe were not up to the task in handling some of the kind of aspects of their campaign that people were looking for. So since then, people have been looking for some progress, I guess, some signs that maybe the campaign was on its way again.
Well, we have sort of transitioned from this period of them not jumping in very much to jumping in certain ways, but they're being criticized for some of the ways they're jumping in, right?
Sure.
Like, today we had a story about a guy in Limestone County.
Yeah.
Who closed up shop on the Democratic office.
Yeah. Bill Bond, 79-year-old rancher and bookstore owner who happens to feel very strongly about open carry. And that's one of the things that Wendy Davis had been talking a little bit about recently. She's spoken pretty unambiguously about expanding gun rights in Texas. That's maybe something that she's saying now is in accordance with her previous positions, but surprised some people, including this guy, and he closed up the shop.
I mean, to me, like, part of what's going on is that, you know, it's pretty hard to run as in Texas with where politics is right now. I mean, you know, Republicans have won all of the last 100-something statewide races. To run is just an, you know, unabashed liberal Democrat. So I think some of what's going on is that she's trying to underscore position she already has that stakes out a little bit of a different territory than the stereotypes that are being pushed on her by the Abbott campaign. The open carry thing to me was a little weird. Just because it kind of came out of the blue, and I find it, you know, a little out of step with her record on guns. She was pretty adamantly opposed to campus carry, and it seemed kind of like a little too obviously like, hey guys, I'm a Democrat, but I'm pro Second Amendment. I mean, I don't expect her to come out and, you know, like Bloomberg or something, and that on gun control. But open carry is not exactly been a mainstream issue. Even in the legislature, the bills that have been filed around open carry never really went anywhere.
I don't think anybody expects her to, like, act on any open carry-related issue, which is why I thought it was strange for her to come out and take a position on it, because people who like Wendy already really would rather that she not probably, you know, send guns into preschools or whatever they're, you know, imagining. And then, you know, people who don't like her are not going to suddenly jump on the bandwagon.
Right. Like, what's the political benefit?
Right.
Well, the polling, I didn't find any polling that was specifically about open carry, but UT and the Texas Tribune had done some pretty good polling asking the question, do you support stricter gun laws, the same, or looser? And the only part of the political spectrum in Texas that was in favor of looser gun laws was Tea Party Republicans. And, you know, I don't work on campaigns and don't have access to their internal polls, but I'm pretty sure that Tea Party Republicans are not going to vote for Wendy Davis. Now, of course, you know, anybody running for governor's got to go pose with a shotgun. You know, got to go hunting, even if they haven't gone hunting since they were kids or something. I'm okay with that. It makes sense. It's kind of par for the course. Open carry thing is a little out of right field. But then maybe we should talk about the other big Wendy Davis kerfuffle. I love that word. Which is
you do love that word. Just the kids, right? Education.
That's right. Well, no, I was going to say the issue of the 20-week abortion ban.
Oh, right. There's that, too.
And maybe one of y'all can
tee
that up
for us. Are there so many kerfluffles that we don't even know which kerfluffle we're talking about?
Kerfluffle gate.
Well, things are starting to pick up in these campaigns. So, yeah, it's a lot more news.
So the deal with what happened was that Wendy has been responding to various newspaper polls, kind of laying her positions out, and she was pretty clear that she, with a lot of caveats and exceptions, supports a 20-week abortion ban, which the national media seems to have found surprising, but is largely in keeping with what she talked about during the filibuster, which was very much about, you know, fetal pain is not scientifically correct and exceptions to the ban are really, really important. And I really, her issue with the bill as it was written was that it didn't have enough exceptions, not that it was a 20-week abortion ban. So I think people are nationally seem to be kind of having a panic moment of accusing Wendy of misleading people or being hypocritical, when in fact she's really been quite consistent on the 20-week ban issue.
Here's my question. Do you think that she's the problem is that she's taking out a position that is pretty nuanced, and that from just a strategic political point of view, our politics doesn't have a whole lot of room for nuance, especially on something like abortion? Reproductive rights. So she's being consistent with what her position has been, specifically on that issue, but it seems like it's really getting lost in all the noise.
Right, yes.
So I guess my question is, what should she have done anything different, even if just from a pure strategic or a tactical point of view?
I wouldn't have had her do anything different. I mean, I think if she came out today and said, I oppose a 20-week abortion ban, I think people should be absolutely be able to get abortions at 22 weeks. She would lose a lot of people that are really uncomfortable with that. You know, a lot of middle of the road kind of moderate Texans who really find that area to be quite problematic and kind of an awkward place to situate yourself in the abortion debate. I can't imagine any mainstream Democrat coming out in favor of repealing a 20-week abortion ban. It's extreme at this point to say that you think abortion should be legal at 23 weeks.
So what specifically are the exceptions that she would like to see in this hypothetical?
She wants to see a mental health exception. She wants to see broader language with regard to fetal anomalies, and she wants to give more leeway to hospitals and doctors and patients to be able to make those decisions. The HB2 didn't have a mental health exception in its language, and that really is a huge deal. So, and she talked about that extensively during the filibuster. You know, she wasn't up there saying, you know, free abortion until 24 weeks. She was up there saying we need a mental health exception.
So how many cases are we talking about per year? I mean, that's another thing is we seem to have, like,
it's a tremendously small amount. It's
hundreds,
less
right?
than 1% of all abortions happen after 20 weeks. The vast majority of those are because of fetal anomaly and the other reason why they happen after 20 weeks for a very, very small group of people is that they were not able to afford an abortion before 20 weeks. They had to wait, 4 weeks to save up money, you know, to pay for their procedure. And that's just a very small amount. I mean, we're talking maybe tens of people.
But what is the scientific or legal justification for banning any abortions between, you know, 20 and 24 weeks where viability kicks in?
I mean, I don't think there is any legal or medical reasoning that is sound for a pre-viability ban. I think that the anti-choice community, anti-choice organizations latched on to 20 weeks because it's 5 months. And a 5 month pregnant person is usually a visibly pregnant person. You know, that is the point at which there's a lot of prenatal diagnosing. It's just kind of a benchmark in pregnancy for a lot of people. And I think it plays well, again, because it is, you really come off as an extremist if you say, yes, I think somebody should be able to get an abortion at 23 weeks, 22 weeks, because most people are imagining, you know, fetuses with arms and legs and fingers and hearts and lungs and
right.
at that point.
Of course, all those national people that are throwing a fuss tantrum about this, they don't have a whole lot of votes, if any, in Texas. So
no,
there is the,
no.
There is that.
Of course, the other bit of news surrounding Wendy Davis lately is she called Greg Abbott out on the school finance trial earlier this week. What do you guys think about how that's playing out?
School finance, our favorite topic.
Yeah, all it's right, Shane so, Patrick's not here because it is actually, I think, his well, favorite topic.
And if we have 3 hours, we might get a slight understanding of it. But no, yeah, that's an important one.
Well, it's interesting. It's education is really the issue that Wendy Davis would rather be waging this campaign over. Her motto is something like "Great schools, great taxes." She's been releasing a series of policy proposals relating to education. The latest one is expanding pre-K in Texas. And she keeps getting kind of distracted by these social issues that we were just talking about. But her latest call is for Greg Abbott to stop prosecuting the school finance case that's been kind of winding its way through the Texas courts for the last couple of years. It lets her put him in kind of an awkward position because he has to stand up to some degree and defend this settlement, and it's a system that's hated by a lot of people in Texas.
Do you think she's been successful in that way? Has her strategy paid off?
Well, it's been interesting in the last 2 weeks. I mean, really, a lot of the headlines that you see, and it's hard to say whether this is the fault of her campaign or the media, have been about, you know, the things that we were just talking about and gay marriage, and she came out for medical marijuana. It's you haven't seen a lot of kind of that message get through. It's something that they're definitely going to be trying to do going forward.
And Democrats running for governor have a long, you know, history of running on education. I mean, I guess it's a quintessential kind of bipartisan cross-political spectrum issue. I mean, you know, rural Texas are very Republican areas. People are still often, you know, very much pro-public schools. There's nowhere else to go. You don't see any value in, you know, charter schools and or vouchers. So, you know, but I guess the question on the school finance trial is she's asking for Abbott to settle the case. And it's a little unclear how he would go about settling the case at this point.
Yeah, especially because the legislature has been going on kind of what the courts are telling them to do, and they've kind of abdicated responsibility for setting some of the parameters of the school finance system. So if the court is not telling them what to do, it's hard to know whether they'll be able to know what to do.
I guess it's possible that he could less aggressively, be adversarial in the court setting, and that might lead to a more expeditious, you know, settlement through the legislative process or whatever. You can't write a bumper sticker about that, though.
Unfortunately not. Does not lead to very clear, direct messaging. Well, guys, thanks for talking about that. I'm sure we'll have another update on the gubernatorial race next week. Maybe. I'm not promising, but probably.
Something might happen.
Something may happen. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And if you were to stop by the office at pretty much any time, you would find a staff of dedicated, maybe addicted, Twitter users. And who can blame us when the Twitterverse is responsible for things like a dream debate between Senator Dan Patrick and San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro? Guys, is this actually happening?
It's hard to tell. It seems like it's probably not going to happen.
How did it get started? That's take us back to the beginning there.
Yeah.
I mean, Julian Castro, of course, is Democratic mayor of San Antonio, rising star, and Dan Patrick is the talk radio show guy who was a very Republican senator from Houston who's also running for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, he's probably the most right-wing guy currently running for statewide office, right? I mean, he's pretty extreme, and he's run his whole campaign on, almost his whole campaign on railing against illegal immigration. He's used a lot of language that people find objectionable.
The illegal invasion.
Yes.
He seems to get a lot of joy out saying illegals with a Z there at the end.
How do you spell it?
I don't.
And so Julian Castro called him out on Twitter.
Yeah, kind of out of the blue, but responding to some of the rhetoric that he'd been using the last month. And Dan Patrick's never been one to pass up an opportunity for a show like this. It challenged him to a debate. A day or two later, Julian Castro accepted. And then they fought about the scheduling of it. Patrick wanted to have it happen before his March primary because he's in a really hot race right now and he thinks he can use it, presumably. Castro wanted to do it after the primary, presumably because he didn't want to help him become lieutenant governor.
But they couldn't decide. Reasons.
They couldn't decide, yeah.
But you seem to be of the opinion, based on what I've read of your work, that this debate should happen. Why do you think that?
Well, I think Patrick should be given a space where he can talk about this at great length. And I think people could benefit from hearing at length how he feels about this illegal invasion. I don't think he's going to say anything, you know, overly stupid or make a mistake. But we're at a moment as a state, we talk about it all the time, where we're dealing with some demographic changes and some social changes, and this debate would really kind of encapsulate some of those. And if this was a different state, the Democratic Party might kind of jump at this opportunity to get Dan Patrick on stage.
Yeah, does Julian Castro actually have any sort of political benefit to gain from this?
That's a good question. He might be seen by some people as stepping up to the task on this, but I think the argument for Democrats is more about getting Patrick on stage than it is for Castro. Although Castro did signal a willingness to do it. He was just kind of toying with Patrick a little bit. So,
but the thing is that of course, some of what's happening in the background here is a lot of Republicans, Steve Ministeri, the leader of the Texas Republican Party, as well as a lot of conservative Hispanic Republicans, George P. Bush among them, you know, get it that the GOP in Texas has got to make inroads among Latinos, or they don't have much of a future. I mean, this is just conventional wisdom now. You look at the numbers. A guy like Dan Patrick is the opposite of a poster boy for Hispanic outreach for Republicans. And so I got to think that, we know this because they've gone on the public record, that the idea of Dan Patrick on stage, maybe televised, railing against illegals against the very popular Hispanic mayor of San Antonio is terrible public relations for them. You got to be wondering if there isn't some people in the background telling Dan Patrick, you know, cease and desist, please.
Yeah, I think it would just come out really well for Democrats in terms of being able to use that opportunity to stake out a position on immigration in Texas that isn't just not Republican.
Right.
You know, Democrats spend so much time playing defense in Texas. I think it would be an interesting opportunity for a really popular, really smart, really, talented Hispanic politician to be able to say, you know, like, here actually is an alternative to that guy who's, you know, pretty mainstream at this point in Texas, even though he is extremely right wing.
One of the funny things to me about Dan Patrick and frankly some of the other lieutenant governor candidates on the border security immigration issue is that it seems to me that it's really not anymore such a pressing issue like it was, say, in the 2005-2007 kind of time frame for a variety of reasons. And yet these guys still, and they're smart politicians, sense, and I would think rightfully so, that their base is still so fired up around illegal immigration that it's risen to near the top of the issues that they're talking about. I think that's pretty remarkable and kind of shows this big divergence among, like, basically who runs the state now, which are, you know, a few hundred thousand Republican primary voters and the broad public at large, of which the Hispanic population is the largest, fastest growing segment.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem notable that so many people are kind of willing to come out on the Republican side and criticize Dan Patrick. Now, you had State Representative Jason Villalba write an editorial. It didn't name Dan Patrick in particular, but it was clearly kind of directed towards him. People like him,
right,
urging him to drop the rhetoric, and
people, or even Jerry Patterson,
yeah,
who I was at the convention when he went on the floor and really urged the delegates, state Republican convention, to change the platform from this really xenophobic, anti-immigrant language to something called the Texas Solution, which sort of sounds ominous, but is some vague guest worker program, but nonetheless, I mean. You know, Jerry Patterson's like a 70-something-year-old, you know, gun-toting, you know, former Marine. He's not somebody you'd immediately expect to lead the way on moving away from some of the rhetoric. But, you know, he gets it. He's willing to criticize Dan Patrick on it. And so, you know, there's a lot of turmoil, I think, within their party.
Well, guys, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. In our February issue, Andrea Grimes explained the dangers of foodborne illness and how the Ad Council is fighting back with a campaign that urges you to clean, separate, cook, and chill. Andrea, why is this campaign important?
It is important because foodborne illness is actually incredibly common, more common probably than most people think. A lot of people don't know, like, really obvious stuff.
And it does seem pretty obvious.
It does seem obvious. But then, you know, to describe the billboards, they're very, very simple. They say really, really easy to digest stuff like, you know, put your meat in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, wash your vegetables before you put them in a salad. So it's really basic stuff. But when you get into the nitty-gritty of a lot of this stuff, there actually is a lot of room to make yourself pretty sick in terms of, like, well, I don't know, how long should this takeout curry be sitting here on the shelf of my fridge? Or, you know, is you know, can I eat pork at 145 degrees or does it really need to be 165 degrees? So it is a good kind of conversation starter and for people who are kind of perhaps new to cooking at home or new to elaborate cooking at home, you know, stuff beyond jar of pasta sauce type of things.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, and it's just one of those nice, it's so kind of retro and throwbacky and, you know, reassuring. Just clean your vegetables, guys. You'll all be fine.
Everything will
be
fine.
You'll be the Cleaver family if you clean your vegetables. Yeah.
One of the things I liked about this piece is that you sort of explained your own transition from somebody who cooks things and makes sure they're well done to someone who can appreciate, you know, things like sashimi. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, Not to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read the piece yet.
Good pun.
But,
good pun. It's a great pun.
when I was in elementary school, my mom was cooking dinner. She was browning ground beef in a pan, and I plucked a little piece of ground beef out of the pan. It's probably about halfway browned. You know, I wasn't just eating like a bloody chunk of ground beef, but it was not done. And my mom kind of, you know, just jumped in and was like, "Andy, stop! Like, don't. No, you're gonna make yourself sick." And of course, I'd already swallowed the thing. And I had just I didn't know about food poisoning. I didn't know about salmonella or listeria or E. coli or anything. And I was just horrified that I put myself, you know, so close to being in danger there. So for the next, like, 20 years, probably, I didn't eat anything other than, like, extremely well-done steak, by which I mean, like, black steak. Right. Basically. Or, you know, sushi would have been absolutely out of the question. I couldn't even eat vegetarian sushi because it looked too much like what I knew raw sushi looked like.
I will admit that I also have an aversion to raw things that I'm trying to overcome because sushi is delicious.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's a little difficult.
It really was hard. And the thing that got me through it was I was hanging out with some new friends, and I didn't want them to think that I was, like, an ignorant little, like, country bumpkin, and we were at the sushi restaurant, and I ordered a hand roll. And so I was served this giant cone of raw, glistening tuna.
Which is what you want when you get a hand roll.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just had to eat it in front of them. Like, I couldn't send it back. Like, these were new friends. I didn't want to seem like I was, like, a nerd or whatever. So I just, like, choked it down. And then I was, like, you know, halfway through it, and I was thinking, this is delicious. This tastes exactly like what I want more of, please, in my life.
Right.
So now I am, I use my food thermometer. And I cook things to the correct temperature instead of, you know, roasting chicken until it, like, looks like powdered sugar on the inside or some kind of jerky.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, yes, I eat my food at the correct temperature now, and it's very freeing, and I recommend it.
Now, who are these ads actually aimed at?
That is a really interesting question that, in fact, the people that I spoke to for the story couldn't answer.
Yeah.
They were like, the ads are for people who don't know this information. And I was like, yes.
That's fair.
But who specifically? And they were like, yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, and that's the beauty of an ad council ad, you know, is that there isn't a target audience, you know, for a billboard that says, like, be nice to people. Because that's basically the ad council jam, is like telling us these, like, you know, feel good, you know, basic information kinds of things. So, you know, I mean, there's not any one population necessarily of people that are more likely to get foodborne illness. You know, it can be more dangerous for, like, small children and older folks. But generally speaking, like, there's not, you know, the ads weren't a response to an outbreak or anything mm-hmm. like that. They're just really fun kind of retro-y ads that, you know, Ad Council produced because they got some money for it. I mean, that's pretty much it.
One aspect that you cover in your piece that I found interesting is that you consider that people who live in food deserts may find this information valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, I think there's a couple of different kinds of people who are new to cooking. You know, there's like a college student who's moved out for the first time on their own in their own apartment and they're cooking. You know, there's the hipster locavore that just discovered that you can pull the bamboo shoots up in your backyard and, you know, eat those.
Can you?
And then there are people who have been, you know, enabled to and empowered to buy fresh food in grocery stores
right.
that they didn't used to have access to. You know, and well, God willing, if food stamp programs continue, they will continue to have access to that kind of thing. So, you know, there are people who I think, you know, have spent a lot of their lives eating, you know, prepared, you know, pantry type items because that's the only thing they had available at the, you know, the corner store or the fast food place around the corner. You know, they didn't have a Whole Foods.
Right.
You know, and now that we're starting to be a little more aware of these food desert issues and starting to address some of those, I think it's, you know, a good chance that it might, you know, you might be 25, you know, and cooking for your own family before you ever had an opportunity to, you know, take a steak home from right. the grocery store, you know. So,
well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Jonathan.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schultz. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.